From UFOs to ghosts and government cover-ups, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now, or learn the stuff they don't want you to know.
Hello, and welcome to Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. I'm Ben Bolin.
And I'm Matt Frederick.
And today we are going to talk about a series that we did. Wow, this is a deep cut, huh, Matt?
Yeah, at least the originals. The original episodes were rather deep.
And that original series was called The Deceptive Brain, or rather present tense is called The Deceptive Brain because you can still see it on YouTube right now. This was a three-part series wherein you and I explored the effects that chemicals have on the brain and, most importantly, the effects that naturally occurring neurochemicals have on the brain, right?
Yeah, exactly. And the ways in which those chemicals kind of trick the brain. It's weird. It tricks itself by releasing chemicals. Mm-hmm. Because when we think about when we say your brain is tricking you, it's really tricking itself. And I thought that was one of the more fascinating things. Because what are we besides our brains, at least the thoughts that we have?
Yeah, and this was funny to us because, you know, sometimes it can be a little bit challenging when we're making an episode to have it always end with something someone doesn't want someone else to know. And this was a little bit different for us because it was your brain, quote unquote, your brain didn't want you to know exactly how it was deceiving or lying to you. But we did see some really interesting stuff. We did we did one episode on love.
We did.
Yeah, we did one episode on hate.
I wanted to go all the way back and do some of the first stuff we talked about with Deceptive Brain. That was some of my favorite.
Okay, yeah, like what?
I learned a lot of things. I'm just going to go off the cuff here. One of my favorite things I learned in the earlier episodes was the trick with the warm cup or a warm beverage in your hand when you speak with someone and how it can affect the way you feel about that person or at least your takeaway feelings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a very interesting series of studies. Like, I can't remember exactly which university it comes out of, but I think it's in our episode there. And this is where, this comes into play where if you and I are talking and like I have coffee right now. Let's see how warm
nice.
It is. I have coffee right now. It's cold though. So watch out. You're on thin ice, my friend. Because if somebody is holding a hot drink, these studies found that they are more likely for some almost, it sounds ridiculous, but they are more likely to regard a person that's speaking to them as nicer. They tend to be a little more empathetic, maybe. But then when they have a cold drink, that effect is reduced and they tend to be more objective. That was interesting to me. And that's something, it's similar to what's called priming, right? Psychologically, subtly, framing a situation such that a person's brain kind of leads them to a predetermined decision point of some sort. And another thing, this is a funny trick, and this I really want people to try this, Matt. Anybody who has an office job, if you have a dog, get a picture of your dog, just your dog. You can be in the picture. It doesn't matter if you are. Just get a picture of your dog and put it on your desk and see if people begin to treat you differently. If you have a cat, don't put a picture of your cat up there because I think this only works with dogs. But there was another, There was another study that found that people who had a photograph of a dog on their desk were more likely to be perceived as team players or supportive people.
Wow.
Yeah, but not so with cats, my friend. And, also, you know, if you want to be a little unethical, it doesn't have to necessarily be your dog.
Oh, just find a funny picture of a dog.
That could be an awkward conversation. Oh, do you have a dog? No. I like this picture because I'm a team player.
Or you could just come up with some elaborate story about that dog and how you used to have it and it went and, you know, lives in a farm now.
Yeah, there's no way that an elaborate lie will ever go wrong.
No, especially in an office environment. So another thing we talked about, Ben, was sleep, how you can hack your sleep and kind of change your brain and the way it works by breaking up your waking and sleeping hours. I think it's called polyphasic sleep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, polyphasic sleep, the sustainability and efficacy of which has been a subject of intense debate people who are familiar with this might see on the internet, what was called, I think, the Uberman sleep schedule, mm-hmm. which I never achieved, but I did 2 4-hour chunks for a while, and then I divided into,
of waking or sleeping? 4 hours.
Sleeping.
Chunk. Okay.
And some people have even argued later on that that is a more natural way of human rest cycles, but I don't know.
I can't think of that book. There was a book that came out not long ago that talked about that, how men and women would sleep for 4 hours, wake up, sometimes engage in, let's say,
witchcraft. Oh, did I guess wrong?
And then sleep for another 4 hours. I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah. And, I was experimenting with that stuff before this book came out, or before I was aware of it. The Uberman sleep schedule, however, I don't know if anyone who's listening has ever successfully done it. I'd love to hear about it, because it's pretty much a series of 20-minute naps, and you're supposed to, the reasoning goes, somehow train your brain to just fall right into REM sleep and then wake up immediately refreshed. But of course, the problem is, in theory, if that works, then you cannot miss a nap by a moment. And then also, I imagine that the other phases of sleep are, in their own way, equally important. So why would you want to cut it out?
Well, because you want to get to that REM cycle so that you can control your dream, right? Because that's where lucid dreaming comes in. And if you can control when you dream and how you dream, then essentially you're not sleeping. You're cognitive at all times.
Yeah, which I wonder, sleep, I always thought sleep sounded like such a strange, hilarious thing. We've talked about it off air, I kind of resent the fact that people have to sleep, and more so than many other animals. But one thing that gets me about this concept is, if you just described it to someone who wasn't familiar with the idea of sleep, it sounds crazy. You would say, oh, guys, I want to hang out, but it's about that time. I've been moving around for a while, so now I'm going to lie down, lose consciousness, and just sort of hallucinate for a few hours, And but I will see you after that.
That's so weird. Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. That's very strange, because you're so vulnerable when you're sleeping. You're not active. You're not achieving anything.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's why lucid dreaming is it's looked at as such an important thing to some people.
Yeah. And, the nature of dreams themselves, that's already a very weird thing, just in terms of both the content and the physical event. It's possible that, maybe some people might object to this statement, but maybe the brain is deceiving people most immediately in dreams, right? But there are other ways they do it in waking life. And what was interesting to us, I think, both of us, about this episode was being able to see exactly what these effects were and the chemicals that have been traced to the root cause. So it's not just one rebellious scientist saying this might happen. There are a bunch of other people that have also researched this, peer-reviewed studies that have, pointed out that feelings of love, for instance, trace back to dopamine, norepinephrine, and phenylethylamine. But those things are linked to a euphoria and addiction, right? So it is possible to get addicted to that feeling.
Yeah, your brain's excretions.
Mm-hmm.
That's fun.
What are some things that really surprised you about the deceptive brain, Matt?
I was surprised that there are techniques and technologies that are being created and devised that will be able to hack the brain. I thought that was super cool. The
transcranial direct current simulation.
That's exactly right. Man, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, so we've probably talked about this ad nauseum for people who are into this, or I've heard the show before, but I am sold on transcranial direct current simulation. So what is this? this is the practice of putting a small amount of electricity through very specific parts of the brain, and through that, creating lasting effects on the way your brain works. So this isn't some made-up Frankenstein sci-fi stuff. It's being used by DARPA to train snipers. It's being used by the Air Force to reduce pilot training time. The idea here is that by putting this electricity through a person's brain, and of course, you know, just like in real estate, when you're zapping your brain, it's location, location, location. And depending on the location you pick, then you can see an increase in memory retention. You can see an increase in the learning curve. And I think there are some kinetic things that people can do, like your hand-eye coordination increases possibly. The weirdest thing, though, is that after exposing somebody's brain to these things on a regular scale, the changes stay. It doesn't just happen while someone's there. It's, I have to remember to put this part at the beginning. Great athletes, great chess players, great experts of various endeavors always have that moment where they describe it as being in the zone. We hear that with athletes, right? Well, transcranial direct current stimulation and a related thing, transcranial magnetic stimulation, can recreate that feeling of being in the zone. And not even just the feeling, they can recreate the way the brain works when one is in, quote unquote, the zone.
Do you get in the zone when you write sometimes?
I mean, that's a really good question. I think for me, it's, yeah, sometimes it does occur, and it might be irrespective of what I'm working on, but I find it most often in fiction because you're just making it up and then all of a sudden you see it and you go, oh, but then if you're reviewing sources and stuff, and you want to make sure that you are actually telling people the truth, then you can still get in the zone. But
yeah,
you know,
it happens to me on a weekly basis here. If I put on the right music, or if I've got enough white noise in the background, sometimes I'll just start seeing the episode unfold before I'm putting any images down.
Yeah.
I like doing that.
That's trippy. That's pretty cool. So we should also talk about this music, because it's true, isn't it, that you found some specific types of auditory or audio stimulation. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's true. I've got a couple different ones. I've got a certain playlist on my iTunes. It's just instrumental music, just music that flows, and it doesn't have, even the beat isn't that intense. Just put your, people would say it puts your brain in a certain alpha waves or whatever. I have no idea. but it really does get you in the place where you can focus on what's directly in front of you. It eliminates distractions around you, because we sit in an office together, all of the editors here.
We literally have a glass office. It is glass on three sides.
That's true. And we sit in that office and we're all editing with our headphones on and clacking away on our keyboards, and it gets a little loud, and you know, we have to constantly share with each other. So you need something you have to hack your brain in a way to focus.
You have to kind of recreate what would be a physical distance.
Exactly.
And now it's time, before we go out, we have to talk about Hate, which was a very interesting episode for us, because we found that studies have shown there is a hate circuit in the brain, and it connects three regions of the brain. There, you know, there's like a love circuit. And of course, love, evolutionarily speaking, makes sense, right?
Yeah, you got to reproduce, man.
Just thank God we're not praying mantis style, you know?
Yeah.
That's a rough deal for the dudes. But hate, it turns out, also has an evolutionary advantage. Like there's a reason that hate exists in the great human mosaic or tapestry or whatever, you know, big thing, the great human thing.
It's about survival, right? All of these things that we're learning about with the brain and how it's working for you and against you, it's about survival. Sometimes, because our conscious thought requires the brain to take over itself.
Yes.
In a weird way.
Yeah. And and hate and love are, you know, it's kind of been a cliche for a long time that hate and love are two sides of the same coin and all that stuff, all that jazz, all that smooth jazz. But the truth is that there is some physiological basis to that comparison, there's a brain region called the putamen, which was so fun to say, P-U-T-A-M-E-N. And this is part of the hate circuit, and it's also associated with love. So maybe they're not that different. And the professor who found some of these studies noted that viewing a loved or hated person could be equally distressing, and that the insula also is involved in responding to distressing situations. And I guess I could see that because, you know, who hasn't been embarrassed in front of a crush? I hope that not everybody has seen someone and immediately wanted them to die, but it happens.
Mm-hmm.
I feel very lucky because I can't specifically recall any moment where I looked at someone and thought, you should die.
Well, I wonder how much that circuit is trained by, let's say, influence from parental figures or societal figures.
Right.
And yeah. I wonder if it's strengthened or if it's dulled in certain people.
You know, we ran into something similar with one of our other shows here at How Stuff Works, at Car Stuff. We looked at neuroplasticity with this thing called the knowledge. And you and I talked about the knowledge, right?
That's fantastic. The London taxi drivers, the test they have to take?
Yes, exactly. It's a beast of a test because you have to memorize not only pretty much all the streets of London, but you also have to memorize specific routes and you have to know alternatives to those routes. And a lot of people, I think the vast majority, fail the first time they take the knowledge. And I mean, it's already a pretty intimidating test. It's called the knowledge.
Yeah.
And, they study, intensely to pass this test. And when they finally do pass this test, they become London cabbies and live happily ever after.
Yeah, I'm sure that's how it goes every time.
I'm sure that's how it goes every single time. That's not even a generalization ever. But what happened is some of the research conducted found that these cab drivers, after decades of service, it's not right out of the jump, but after decades, they had larger areas of the brain associated with memory and 3D space navigation, you know. So it's possible that there is real life mind over matter. Your thoughts, the things that you try to think about, and the things to which you apply your consciousness can have a physical effect on the makeup of your brain. They also found, they being scientists, also not the drivers, also found that there was a similar effect in some, I believe they were Buddhist monks who had spent decades meditating on compassion and kindness. And, they had a larger part of the brain associated with, you know, like empathy and kindness and mirror neurons and stuff like that. And so it's strange because when to respond to that point about hate kind of makes me think, yeah, is it possible that you could train somebody in the opposite direction?
I think mostly just I'm interested in where we can go with this, and it makes me want to meditate more and read more and study the maps of Atlanta more and possibly increase the size of my brain all over.
And for a literary reference, the idea of training people to hate makes me think of Goldstein and the 2-Minute Hate in 1984. And maybe it is possible to kind of ritualize that. We do also know that it is a tale as old as time, to take the line from Beauty and the Beast, that groups of people do tend to concentrate hate towards some other outside entity. Defining something as not us gives a more cohesive identity to a community or group of people.
It's especially helpful if you have an overseer or a government and or someone above you telling you that that's what you should hate.
Yes. Yes. And we're not saying that that is what we would do if we were ever in charge of something. But I think we'd be okay at being in charge of stuff. All right. Well, we better get out of here and work on our meditation before that stuff all comes into play. Let's see. Let's tell people about our Facebook.
Hey, guys, if you like this and you want to find out more, we've got a playlist on our YouTube page. That's youtube.com/conspiracystuff, and it's the Deceptive Brain series. You can talk to us on Twitter. We are at Conspiracy Stuff, and you can also find us on Facebook. We're also Conspiracy Stuff there.
Or you can send us an email directly if you want to skip the whole social media kerfuffle. We are conspiracy@discovery.com.
For more on this topic and other unexplained phenomena, visit testtube.com/conspiracy stuff. You can also get in touch on Twitter at the handle @conspiracystuff.